Are you still there?
Yes, we are.
Okay, I can just barely hear you.
Don't start talking yet. We're starting the show. Network, and that's Dwight Tribble. I've known Rivers, and we have in the studio two professors, John Edgar Tidwell and Carmelita M. Williams, and they're going to be speaking to us about the unexamined letters of Langston Hughes' mother to her son and how that impacted Langston Hughes' early work. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm going to read your bios first and talk a little bit about your book, and then we can get started on this wonderful conversation about the unofficial poet laureate, the first here in these United States of America. As the unofficial Black poet laureate and leader of the Harlem Renaissance, Langston Hughes remains a key figure celebrated as part of Black History Month each February, his birthday being the first day, February 1st. Although Hughes was often gregarious in public, he kept a protective veil over his private life, making it challenging for scholars to get key insight into who this great artist was on a deeper level. As already mentioned, two Kansas scholars, including University of Kansas English professor John Edgar Tidwell, who's on the air right now, and Professor Dr. Carmelita M. Williams, professor of English and African American Studies at Johnston County Community College in Overland Park, Kansas, are the authors of this wonderful book, My Dear Boy, and it's so cool the way she begins all these letters, My Dear Boy. Carrie Hughes' letter to Langston Hughes, 1926 to 1938, with a foreword by Nikki Finney, which is really, really wonderful the way she talks about how Hughes impacted her life. It's really remarkable. It's like, wow, what synergy. So Dr. Tidwell is professor again of English at the University of Kansas, and among his several courses, he teaches survey classes in American and African American literatures, major author courses in Gordon Parks, Sterling Brown, Langston Hughes, and Zora Neale Hurston, and an introduction to the study of fiction. His previous books include Montage of a Dream, The Art and Life of Langston Hughes, After Winter, The Art and Life of Sterling Brown, and Writings of Frank Marshall Davis, A Voice of the Black Press. Coinciding with his teaching, his areas of research are American and African American literatures. He has published 6 books and a considerable number of essays, book reviews, literary dictionary entries, interviews, and a bibliography. For the Kansas Humanities Council Speakers Bureau, he has presented Against the Odds, Writers Growing Up Black in Kansas, and Gordon Parks' Learning Tree Experience. Recently, he joined the KHC Talk About Literature in Kansas Talk program, conducting discussions thus far in the African American Experience series. In 2001 to 2002, he served as project director for Reading and Remembering Langston Hughes, funded in part by the Kansas Humanities Council. Prior to that, he was a resident scholar for the Humanities Council's Crossing Boundaries, Making Connections, African American and American Culture program in spring 1996. He was born and grew up in Independence, Kansas. What a nice town, Independence.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's a great name. Wow. Is that a black town?
No, it's not a black town. It's a smaller town now. Actually, it was small when I grew up there. It was about 13,000. But now they're down to around 8,500, maybe 9,000 people.
Mm, wow. That's real cozy.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Well, welcome. Welcome.
Thanks so very much.
Oh, you're welcome. And Dr. Carmeletta M. Williams, Professor of English and African American Studies at Johnson County Community College in Overland Park, Kansas, is the author of Langston Hughes in the Classroom, Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, and Of Two Spirits, American Indian and African American Oral Histories. She has won a number of distinguished teaching awards, including the Burlington Northern
Santa Fe Railroad.
Oh, Santa Fe. Okay, yeah, the Fe is missing. Santa Fe Faculty Achievement Award, two Distinguished Service Awards from Johnson County Community College, the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, Kansas Professor of the Year, and the League of Innovations Innovation of the Year Award for her videotape, Sankofa, My Journey Home. Hmm. This video was a result of her Fulbright Hayes Award for studying Ghana, West Africa. Oh, wow. So are you the call and response voice in the intro or the prologue?
Well, we tried to structure the whole book that way.
And you recently returned from Guinea, West Africa, where you established a faculty exchange between L'École Nationale des... I'm really not messing up the French here. Do you want to do it for me?
L'École Nationale des Postes et Télécommunications.
Yeah, great. And Johnson County Community College.
Yeah.
Wow. And you graduated from University of Kansas in 2000 with a doctorate in English.
Yeah.
Wow, what a great team you are. How did you come to know each other? I mean, I know you both have Langston Hughes in common. But other than that, how did you all forge this academic relationship that resulted in this wonderful work, My Dear Boy?
Well, when we first met, when the Kansas Humanities Council was hosting the Crossing Boundaries program, and Edgar lived in Ohio, and I live in Missouri, and the purpose of the workshop, it was a summer workshop, was to work with high school teachers on how to incorporate ethnic literatures into their curriculums. So we met there, didn't really like each other, because he is a Sterling Brown scholar, and I'm a Zora Neale Hurston scholar, and Zora and Sterling didn't get along, and true to form, we didn't get along. But we realized that the scholarship was deeper than that, and then we have a personal relationship. Edgar's my partner. So we worked. In fact, these letters came about because Edgar edited a book with Cheryl Rager called Montage of a Dream, The Art and Life of Langston Hughes. And in that collection, I co-edited an article, Mother to Son, with a woman, Regina Williams, about the letters. But we just did a snippet of the letters and talked a bit. And that article was so well received that the press said, would you be interested in doing the entire letters? And of course I was. And that's how we got this project going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Dr. Tidwell, you want to chime in here about sort of this whole idea of, you know, collaborative scholarship and how it worked for you?
This is one of several collaborative projects I've embarked upon. So I didn't come to this sort of empty-handed. I came with a little bit of experience. And I was happy to be invited to participate in this one because I could tell that there was something very important going on here. And when I was invited to come in, part of what I needed to do from my standpoint was to look to see how we might be able to frame the letters in such a way so that it made much more sense to the reader. The letters themselves are kind of ordinary in many respects. There's a lot of discussion about a movement of family members, requests for monies, all kinds of what seemingly seemed to be trivial information. So based on just that, there probably would not be much interest invoked in the reader. So what we had to try to do was to figure out how we could come up with a method that would enable us to point out the significance of these letters, not just in and of themselves, but what they revealed about the nature of the family relationships that we wanted to explore. And so that's what gave rise to a Bowen family systems theory. We self-consciously try not to become Freudians because Freudian psychology focuses more on the individual. We were interested in family dynamics, and so the method that seems to best accommodate that kind of approach is Bowen's family systems theory. And so we looked at the seven principles that Murray Bowen has, and we selected three that seem to be right up our alley in terms of establishing a connection between Langston and his mother, Carrie. And so as we looked at the letters, then we were able then to say that here are some features of the letters that help us to flesh out the nature of the relationship between Carrie and Langston. And so that becomes actually the first part of what we were about the business of doing. So you mentioned the term call and response. Well, the call actually is in our prologue in which we introduce Carrie and then Bowen Family Systems Theory. The response is through Langston, but not in letters that he wrote back to her, but we looked at the various things he wrote in those years, 1926 until her death in 1938. And we tried to figure out which pieces that he wrote seemed to take up family issues. And what we were seeking to do was to show that if you look at very carefully at those pieces that he wrote in those years, then that becomes his way of responding to the letters that his mother wrote. So therefore, the call and the response.
And the reason we looked at family systems is that all scholars remark about their relationship, and they say things like Carrie was very selfish or their relationship was dysfunctional, but nobody ever gets to the why, and that's what we wanted to explore. Carrie grew up very privileged in Lawrence, Kansas, and after her father died, it's as if her life just got on the skids, and she never recovered from that. So we wanted to look at something that would kind of explain what had happened to her, what happened from the time that she was the belle of Black Lawrence to the time when she was writing Langston and saying, you know, if you love me, you will send me money. And so that's why we chose family dynamics for this, to get a complete look. And we know her family history. She came from a very proud abolitionist family, and her uncle is the person after whom Langston University was named. So she comes from this rich cultural and historical heritage, and so what happened to her? And Bowen Family Systems Theory then gives us an answer to that, or a way at least to explore that. And Langston, you know, the name of my teacher's guide is Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, and I think this is the way we hear from him. I think he very clearly says, okay, you got me. This is what it was about. Because even people who were close to him say, you know, he talks all the time, but we really don't know anything about him. And I think that all the time he was talking through his writing, and he's giving us these answers, and I think they surface in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. When you mentioned you know, this Bowen's theory, mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. focus on differentiation,
mm-hmm.
Fusion or enmeshment,
mm-hmm.
and triangulation.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if maybe you could tell our audience sort of what that means. And when I was reading, you know, the book, as much as I got through it, I really loved the chronology in the beginning, because I didn't know that the Hughes's family, I mean, they were like revolutionary, like seriously, going back to the beginning of this country's history. And I'm like, whoa. And then I don't remember which relative of his, but one of his relatives was the president of Howard. And I'm wondering, like, well, why should he have to wait to get news of a scholarship when his relative was the president? They should give him a scholarship. Like, you know, I got family there.
Yeah.
And then the whole idea of his mother struggling with finances,
mm-hmm.
America should have made sure that this family was well taken care of, because of all the sacrifice, personal sacrifice that their ancestors and, you know, in family that, you know, is still present had done to establish, you know, our nation separate from Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things
I
we have to keep in mind is that we're talking about the Depression years.
Yeah.
And we're talking about the fact that black people were, in a sense, the last hired and the first fired. And I say that as a way of suggesting that the Depression actually had an impact on African Americans well before the official Depression set in. And so there were people, African Americans and other folks, who were already being disadvantaged. So by the time the stock market crashes in 1929 and the Depression sets in a couple of years, then what we find is that black people are already suffering in many ways. And so Carrie's life is caught up in how to survive in an uncertain economic climate. And so this is one of the reasons that we wanted to look more closely at some of the choices that she made. And so we see her moving about from place to place, often just for survival. And when it came to relationships, she and her first husband did not make it. It's even unclear whether James Hughes was there when Langston was born in Joplin, Missouri, in 1902. But at some point they did get a divorce, and she creates this relationship with Homer, and with Homer it becomes a period in which she follows him around trying to find a place where they can establish a home. But all of this is affected by the Depression in and of itself.
You know, one of the beauties about the letters, too, is that Carrie talks about those conditions. We know about Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal, and she writes about that the NRA is the Negro runaround, and how black people are more adversely affected than anybody else by what's going on there. So, I'm sorry, I got this nasal thing. But so we learn these things and we start to see Carrie, but also we start to see black America in larger terms too, what's going on with them, how come it's the Negro runaround, how come there's problems with black folks getting to be part of the Four Seas camp, which was a way for young black men to make money, and her stepson then becomes part of that. So it's also a rich look into the context at the time, what's going on culturally for black folk. And I think it's really interesting for you to say, how come they didn't just give him a scholarship? Because we would hope that, right?
Mm-hmm.
We would hope that would have happened for them, and it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen for him. It doesn't happen for her. Carrie does have a degree from Langston University named after her uncle, the one that you just mentioned, but she doesn't teach, and she has a teaching degree. So all of those things, I think, weave into making her this wonderfully mysterious character who probably could have done much better for herself and chose not to. So why is it then? How come her life is so hard? It's really, really interesting.
And then the way you go in and out of this theory, you know, okay, well, this is because, you know, they're not differentiated enough. Or well, this is using length as a part of this triangular thing. You know, it's like, okay.
And it really becomes interesting, too, when you see how Carrie uses him. You know, she tells Langston, well, you know, I told Dad, who is Homer, the second husband that Edgar was just talking about, that you'll be home and you'll fix it. Well, she has a husband. So why is she pulling the son into there? So it becomes extremely, extremely interesting when you look at the family dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, part of the problem for Langston, too, is that he's given an ultimatum by by his mother. You know, around 1930 or 1931, she feels that he is old enough now to be of help to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she puts him in very direct terms that I need you to support. Now, this is interesting because she has a husband, mm-hmm. and she is invoking the son to become a source of financial assistance to her. And so Langston even at that point decides that, well, I've got to make a decision here. I'm going to give myself the rest of the year, and if I think that I can make it as an author, then I will continue to do that. Otherwise, I'll have to accede to my mother's wishes and see if I can find a job at a time in the Depression when jobs are very hard to come by. So for us, it becomes a dilemma between becoming an author and becoming a laborer. And so we're glad that he chose to become an author because his legacy has left us a lot that we can be proud of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, it's, I don't know, I just think poor Langston. As I read his mother's letters, the introduction to these different sections, which I think the titles are just really provocative. Dreams deferred, zenith and descent, things fall apart. I think of it, you know, Chinua Achebe.
Mm-hmm.
Dear lovely death, and you have your coda and the epilogue and the second coda. It really gives a wonderful overview of what's to come and, sort of contextualizing, you know, the work. And I love your footnotes. Oh, they are so helpful. I don't know any of these folks. I mean, I know some of them. Zora, of course, I know Zora.
Yeah.
And Douglas, I know Douglas. But some of these other folks, I'm like, wow, really?
Good.
Yeah, really, really helpful.
Great.
Yeah, so back to, I interrupted you, but back to just sort of for our audience, just sort of talking about, you know, Bowen's theory, the three parts that you talk about, if you could maybe explain, you know, what differentiation is and the fusion or enmeshment and triangulation. And the triangulation is almost like strangulation, right? You know, what it means for Langston. But I think he has this resolve or this inner reserve where, mm-hmm. you know, if he's far away enough from his mother, like going to another country far, far away,
yes.
she can't get him. So that's really smart of him. I mean, I don't think it might be conscious, but to go to Russia or to go, mm-hmm. like, she's wherever she is, and she's not moving that much because she's so poor. she can't get there, so she'll write these letters, but he – I'm sorry, Mom. I mean, I'm in wherever I am, and you know, and he like takes years away. That is so good, so you get his work done, you know.
Yeah, but I think it's very conscious on his part because he knows that they have this stifling, strangling, you know, wonderful word you use, relationship, and he does purposefully try to exit from that. But he takes care of her, even when he's gone. He pays her rent in advance and. And there's some gossip there, but it's in the book. But he does that to give himself some space from her because he knows that that is a relationship that he cannot thrive in. And to be fully differentiated means that you are able to be part of a community, yet maintain your own individuality. And Carrie doesn't want that. She wants them to be together and the same. And when we look at this, when we look at the family dynamics, then we see somebody like Langston who is struggling, really struggling, to be his own self. Remember, he was raised by a grandmother and largely by himself. When he graduates from high school, there are no family people there. Carrie's not there. She's chasing her husband around places. Langston sends himself through high school, and he has become really aware that this is the way that his life works for him, is if he has this separation. But he very much loves her and wants to be a part of this relationship, and that's why he caves. He keeps caving into her demands because she always connects them with loving her. If you really love me, you'll send me a coat. If you really love me, you'll give me a ticket. And so he caves into this because he wants that relationship. But his survival instinct says, if I am going to be fully differentiated, if I am going to be myself, then these are the things that I have to do. And one is to find space away from her.
It is really something when you all share with us how he, when he was in high school, he was living in an attic apartment.
Yeah.
And the family was gone. I mean, they were there when he was, I don't know what grade he was in, but, and then they left.
Yeah.
And he wanted to finish school there. And she kept on dropping him off. Like,
mm-hmm. And he actually went with him, and
mm-hmm.
Carrie says, you know what, you're old enough now, and you need to drop out of school and work. And he goes like, no, I got to go back to Cleveland. And so he leaves. That time he leaves. He initiates
mm-hmm.
the leave so that he can survive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you all mentioned how she tells him that education is not important when, in fact, you know, everyone around her when she was coming
mm-hmm.
up was talking about and demonstrating that education was very important, including her with a college degree.
Yes,
inconsistent.
Well, the whole idea that education has always been considered the ticket out.
Mm-hmm.
In order for the race to advance, one has to have the sort of educational background to understand the overall social dynamic, and then to try to figure out how to negotiate within that. And so for Carrie to all of a sudden suggest to him that education is not important, it's like almost a violation of everything that she was brought up to understand and to believe.
Mm-hmm. And her father and her brother are the editors of the Black newspaper in Lawrence. So not only learning but also sharing what you know with other people has always been important in her family, but it all morphs into something very selfish and very much just for Carrie. And we watch it happen. We watch it through the letters. We watch this happen. We watch her change. We watch her whole family attitude. Her mother's first husband gets injured at Harper's Ferry, and some people find him and wrap him in a shawl and take him to a barn and try to nurse him back to health, but he dies. And they send this shawl to her mother. She writes Langston and says, let's sell the shawl.
Yes. Get $500 for it so I could buy this.
Yeah.
What she wants to buy. I'm like, what? I'm so happy he took it and put it in the safe deposit box.
Yeah.
He knows his mother.
And that was the research. Yeah. Is like, okay, where is it? Where is it? Surely he didn't let her do that. Yeah.
Ah, mm-hmm. Wow.
Like, you said no, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really.
But you can see how Langston was indeed a dutiful son. Because he did try his best in his own way to preserve the family history in this small way. But he also took care of her as best he could. The problem for Carrie is that every time she saw his name in print, she associated that with big dollars.
Yeah.
And, of course, he did not make a lot of money from his writing. And so she was mistaken. But we know that she was mistaken, but for some reason she didn't quite understand that. And so people around her even tried to explain that you know, she was always racking on Langton for money because she associated the selling of books, which were not very high price, you know, comparatively speaking. But he did not make a lot of money from all of the work that he did. But nevertheless, she continued to beg and entreat him to provide some sort of financial assistance for her.
Yeah, and I love the letter where she writes him and she says, well, I went down to the county welfare office, but they denied me because my son is rich. Like, what in the world would make them think that except you told them?
Yeah.
And of course, that becomes wonderful. One of those emotional manipulations that she performs, because in another letter she talks about, well, I guess I will go out to the poorhouse, the county farm,
and
live, you know, because I have nothing else, you know, I have reached rock bottom. And so I know it's going to be embarrassing to you to find out that, you know, your mother is living at the county poor farm, but that's what I'm reduced to at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So she manipulates him in these various ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So because he knew that she was really theatrical, you know, she actually had a stage career, know, when she was younger and was, you know, sort of really, she really wanted another one. That's why, you know, I guess maybe she did the housekeeping work and taking care of children as opposed to looking at another more lucrative career as like teaching would have been. Did he have friends around that he could touch bases with to make sure that his mother was really in the condition she said, since he knew that she exaggerated what was going on with her? Like when she said she was going to die or she said that she was in the poorhouse, did he? Because I know you read other letters of his, did he have, like, friends that he might touch bases with to check on her to see if it was as bad as she said it was?
Mm-hmm.
So he wouldn't worry?
And they had a huge family, but also he had a stepbrother that Carrie's raising. Homer brought a son into the marriage, and he kept in touch with him, friends. And Carrie's getting in touch with all of these people, his agents, his friends, and telling them, you know, Langston's abandoned me. I don't know where he is. And so he does know. Also, there's letters from her doctors. The doctors write him because Carrie says send him the bill. So when they send him the bill, then they put a note in there that says, you know, your mother's condition is extreme. So he does know that she is sick. But that's the later years.
Yeah, and
she chooses not to have the mastectomy. She goes ahead and has the radiation, but chooses not to have the mastectomy because her sister-in-law, Langston's father's sister, had died from breast cancer, and she had had the surgery. But there's so many rich, rich stories running through the book, and some of it is real. Carrie's not fabricating all of this, but always she is at the middle. She's at the middle, and she doesn't see herself as being in control of the family dynamics, in a sense. It's all about her needs, what she wants. She even writes him and says, Langston, I've been thinking about this. Have I been a good mother? Mm-hmm. And when we read that, right, we want to laugh. Like, are you kidding? Of course you have, and you've abandoned him from the time he was a toddler. But then we come to realize that she's serious about that. So then we have to think through and read through those letters again. And what in the world would ever make her think that she was a good mother? And the stories are there. It's incredibly
rich. Well, I think part of the problem for her is that she is starting to look at her life, and she's starting to conduct self-assessment. And with the cancer especially, I think it probably puts her into a different frame of mind, and she engages in stock taking about her life. And so a lot of this questioning comes about, I think, at a point when she knows that she may not be long for this world. And so she's trying to understand just exactly what she's managed to accomplish in the life that she has been given.
Some of it, but then there's other times when she asks him if he's a good mother, she finds herself alone on Mother's Day. Langston's in California. Kid is off with his girlfriend, and all of the other relatives are busy doing their own thing. And she realizes that she's by herself. And that's when she starts to question, well, how come I'm here? How come people aren't at my foot praising me? And she, because she doesn't think that she's done anything wrong. When we read about Langston's godmother, Mrs. Charlotte Osgood Mason, and how she went out of her way to try to make things happen for Carrie and her her stepson so that Langston can be free to fly, and Carrie sabotages that, she thinks she's doing it on good reason. And, you know, we read her reasons, and we're like, well, okay. But always, always, she can justify that in her mind and in her heart that she's doing the good thing, right? But as readers looking in, voyeurs, in a sense, and their lives are going like, Carrie, come on, Carrie.
Yeah, she seems to be trapped, similar to the way, I believe, when someone is incarcerated at a young age, let's say, like very young, like 17, 18, and they spend, let's say, 30 years, 50 years, 20-something years behind bars, and they come out, and they're still 18, because prison was like being a suspended animation. So in some ways, it seems that Carrie is stuck back when she was the belle of the ball, you know, and she was the toast of the town when she was like 18, 17, 16, before, you know, adulthood sort of really came in full swing and she got married and was a mother. It seemed like she's like stuck in that spot. Even though she knows life has moved on, she doesn't want to move on with it. She seems to be, you know, in that, developmentally in that, still not grown yet.
That's interesting because she is still stuck in that entitlement stage. You know, she's the baby of the family, and she has an older sister, and brothers, and a father, and they all dote on her, and people in the churches, and all across Lawrence, you know, they love her, they include her. So she is truly the belle of Black Lawrence. And then, so that sense of entitlement that she develops never disappears. And even as she struggles, you know, as an adult to go through life, she still has that why aren't people rushing to my aid? And in some of the letters, she'll say things like, well, I have to move because they don't have any money and they can't do anything for me. And we hear that a lot as we read through the letters about her and her needs and what she expects people to do for her. And then it gets even worse as she gets sick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then back to, you know, her letters of, I guess, being contrite, so to speak, but not really, to her son, I just love my dear boy, and then that's the only positive aspect of the letter, if you don't give me the money or whatever. But some of those letters happen to be on his birthday. There are quite a few I read that were February 1st before she got sick, because I haven't even got to those letters yet, where she is asking him, you know, just praising him, like, you know, he's such a great son, and and I'm like, well, this is nice, and I was like, and I'm looking for, you know, like some kind of something, you know, like, okay, she must want something.
The other shoe does fall, because she begins with praise, but she always winds up with a hand out.
Mm-hmm.
But she does love him in her own mixed up way. And when she says, you know, you're so good, and people are bragging about you, and when I went to this performance, they made me stand, and people clapped because I was your mother. You know, she's proud of him, very much so, especially as it makes her look good, right?
Yeah.
But she does, in her own mixed-up way, really love him, but the major part of her won't let her let go of that obligation that she feels that he has. And he writes, you know, about that, you know, if children need to be born, why do they need to have parents? So he writes about this, and we see his reaction there, because he never says, I'm not going to send you money, because she doesn't respond to that. You know, when she writes him, she'll say, okay, well, you said the check's in the mail, the money order's in the mail. I didn't get it, so I'm fighting with the people at the post office. But she never writes and says, well, what do you mean you're not going to send me any money? So that never happens. And instead, he keeps trying to appease her and keeps trying to build on this relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you know, Dr. Joy DeGruy, she writes about how, you know, in a society where the individual is really celebrated,
mm-hmm.
As African people, which I really like about, you know, sort of the way your book is situated, you know, we're relationship people. It's about
right.
the relationship,
mm-hmm.
not about the individual. It's about
That's
us,
right.
not me. And so that explains, and also this theory that you share with us, why Hughes, despite the dysfunction, he really needs his mother.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he keeps on, like, trying to make this thing work to the
mm-hmm.
end, you know, when he's taking care of her as she's dying. And after that, when he's being sued because he owes some money on her funeral arrangement.
For the funeral,
yeah.
It makes it kind of interesting because he had a choice. Both of his parents were problematic for him. His father, of course, wanted him to grow up and be just like him, his father. That is to say, when James left the United States and headed for Mexico, he did so because he felt that racism was just so entrenched here that black people did not have a chance, or if they did have a chance, they did not really exercise that opportunity. And so what does he do? He goes to Mexico, and he becomes very much like the white people who were oppressing black people in the United States. So he treats the Mexicans in that way. And so he wants Langston to emulate him. And so he wants Langston to go to school in Switzerland and to learn engineering. And Langston manages to get him to compromise and say, well, I'll go to Columbia. Well, of course, the reason that Langston wants to go to Columbia University in New York is that there's something called the Harlem Renaissance going on, and that's where he wants to be. So after a year of study there, obviously he did not go to class, and he was not a distinguished student, and he drops out. And so he does not follow in his father's wake. But at the same time, it's an admirable thing that even though his mother was pressing him for all kinds of financial assistance, he never abandoned her. He could abandon his father because he felt that his father was filled with self-hate and racial hate, but he could not abandon his mother, so he always took care of her. So that's one of the things that we always have to call attention to, is that despite her efforts to work with him in such a way as to make him a part of the support network that she needed, he resisted in every way that he could, but he never resisted helping her. So that made him a dutiful son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he was a very good son, considering, you know, mm-hmm. all of the challenges the relationship, you know, afforded him that I wasn't aware of. And then when you all at the in the epilogue, you know, share like how he worked this out through his work, his art, that is really remarkable. So I want to leave you some time to talk about that, you know, the various pieces that you share, Not Without Laughter, and quite great detail, looking at the various characters, a lot of which is mentioned earlier on in the book, The Negro Mother. He's got quite a few poems. He talks about mothers, Soul Gone Home, and is that the last one? I think that might. Yeah, that's the last one you mentioned. But I wanted to ask you about his uncle Dessalines, because I love that. It's like, whoa, Dessalines. They were like, whoa, the name of the child, Dessalines. Like, they know something.
He's
like,
from
wow.
a revolutionary family. You know,
I know.
Family.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't an accident that Des got his name that way. The whole family was socially active and politically active and, you know, back from abolitionism. So he comes from, you know, this revolutionary family. His grandmother's first husband at Harper's Ferry, you know. So it's not unusual. So we see this fight in his genetic makeup. And that's why I think it's surprising to us that Carrie doesn't have that or somehow abandons that.
Well, and I think we also need to, again, give credit to his grandmother for sitting him down and telling him all the family history mm-hmm. the way that she did when Carrie was out and about. Here it falls to his grandmother to rear him.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that she did was she instilled in him a sense of the abolitionist tradition that Langston had inherited from his family. So a lot of that gets played out, I think, in the various works that we see Langston actually create. These are the things that are very important to him. He doesn't write necessarily historically, but he does write with a sense of the significance of African Americans as a people. And I think that comes primarily from his grandmother.
And we come to realize a couple of things, that Langston didn't always tell the truth and nothing but, because when he writes Not Without Laughter, he says, my family wasn't typical, so I had to make up one like the people I grew up with in Kansas. Well, that's exactly what he did. He used his own family. And I think the three sisters are different aspects of Carrie. The Tempe, the upscale daughter who's
bourgeois.
Married. Huh?
Bourgeois.
yes. Whose husband, Mr. Siles, is just colorless because they have ascended, right? And they don't have much time for their mother because she makes her living with her hands in the tub. That's the Carrie who writes him for tickets to go to the Interstate Literary Society meetings that her father established, etc. Harriet, the blues princess of the blues, is that part of Carrie that always wanted to be on the stage and perform. She writes Langston that your mother's dreams have been realized at last. I'm now a principal in Hall Johnson's Run Little Chillin'. And then Angie, the one who runs after Jim Boy and causes him to lose his center and thus he disappears on her, that's Carrie and Homer. She's always after Homer till finally Homer, like Jim Boy, just disappears. So he's not absolutely honest when he says, I made this one up. Those are Carrie's. Those are aspects of Carrie. One thing I think that really struck me about the lessons, another part of Bowen is the multi-generational transmission of family history, and his grandmother gave him that. But he boils it down and says one of the things that was most important that he learned from his grandmother is that people didn't cry in her stories, and so he doesn't cry. But we see him very much torn apart by things that are happening in his relationship or not happening in his relationship with Carrie. But instead, he doesn't cry. He does like the people in his grandmother's stories, and he tries to make it work. And, you know, eventually it doesn't. But he's given it all he could, and he's tried as hard as he could to make that work, because you don't cry. You just keep working towards that goal. We see him making other family members with the Negro mother. That's Mary McLeod Bethune. She has fulfilled those parts of nourishment, of artistic nourishment, that Carrie didn't do for him. So she is actually the person that he's writing about in the Negro mother. He builds a functional family, which is extremely important. If you don't have those relationships, then you build them with someone else. He builds them with Arna Bontomps. I have an article out there, here I go, self-aggrandizing, about that relationship that he built with Arna Bontomps, a functional family. So Carrie is his main goal, is to make a relationship with his mother. He writes about that in so many ways, but ultimately he realizes that he can't just wait on that to happen. So he builds other relationships, and we also see that through this book.
Well, my favorite is the Soul Gone Home, the play, where you have, it's a very short play. I mean, it's a marvelous play. It's so much compacted in about four pages. And the plot is you have a character who has died, a young man who has died, and his mother comes in to view the body, and all of a sudden Ronnie, the name of the character, sits up and he begins to scold her for all the things that she did wrong as a mother. And it puts her on the defensive, and she tries her best to say that I did the best I could possibly do, but we're not wholly convinced that she's persuasive, because there are a number of things that he points out that with just a little bit of effort, she probably could have made things a little bit better for him and prolonged his life. And so the way in which the story operates, the dead talking back to the living, it's a kind of a time-honored tradition in literature, but it's a sort of fascinating way in which I think Langston is speaking through this character to accuse his own mother of things that she did along the way, which she could have improved upon had she been a little more diligent as a mother.
And, you know, you brought up about all the praising that she does of Langston, and especially on his birthday. And so we saw that in The Simple Stories, is that it's like an obituary, right? You're great, you're marvelous, you're wonderful. And so he has Simple then, and The Simple Stories tell Boyd, I'm going to write my own obituary. And when I do this, this is what I'm going to say. So there are lots of humorous ways that he reacted to her, as well as the more serious. But remember, Hughes liked having fun. And when he writes about the blues, he says, you know, the blues are sad, but when people sing them, they laugh. And so a lot of this, rather than just tear him down and tear him apart because this relationship doesn't work, instead he builds on them, and he builds it through his art so that people like us, you know, years later, 100 years after he was born, read these things and we go, oh, okay, well, you know, that's fun. I'm enjoying this. And he's there. That relationship didn't make it or last, but the way he responded to her in his art, it's still there. We're still enjoying it. He's still being recognized for it. So all of that hard work and fights against his father and his mother actually paid off, I think, for him in major ways for us as people who love Langston Hughes.
Yeah. Maybe you could talk for a minute about the Haggard and Haggard character in Not Without Laughter. And then also, I think I had another question. I wanted to ask you about how his relationship with his mother might have impacted his relationship with women, because, you know, since his death, there have been, you know, people have said that Langston Hughes was gay, and I don't know if he was or not, because he's, I, as far as I know, he didn't say it, but maybe you know that he did. I don't know.
Well, Anne Haeger is a marvelous character, and in many ways, I think she's sort of like the moral center of the novel, Not Without Laughter. As Dr. Williams said a moment ago, when Langston wrote about his own family, he had to reinvent them. He had made a decision in the mid-1920s that he wanted to write a novel about those people in the Midwest, especially those people that he knew in Kansas, and he's talking about African-American people. But what he had in mind, though, was not the sort of thing that his grandmother actually represented. You know, she was she never spoke dialect, he said. She never took in washing. She never went to church, and she never did all those things. But when he reinvented his family, he reinvented his grandmother so that she embraced all of those things about going to church, about taking in washing, and so forth, because those were the core values that he saw emerging in African-American people. And he had this undeniable love affair with the people furthest down. I always say the low down folks because he uses that phrase in one of his essays. And he says it with reverence. He says it with a deep appreciation and with a deep felt love for the people furthest down because he saw them as very special, very distinctive, people who were not afraid to be who they were and to be themselves. And so those are the values that he tended to represent. And I think many of those get embodied in Anne Hager because in some ways I think she is one of the moral centers of the text itself.
Yeah, and she also carries, you know, the connotation of, you know, the biblical connotation of the single mother, you know, who took care of her child. You know, she was in the desert and she searched for the water and she found it. She nurtured her son in a way that his mother didn't necessarily nurture him.
As for him being gay, I don't think he was. I think that he may have been bisexual. But we have many stories of women who were willing to leave their families or commit suicide or leave dowries, rich girls who are going to leave their dowries behind or their husbands behind for him. So we know that he did have many relationships with women. The relationships with men are speculative, and most of them are just rooted on, well, he has this poem, I have a friend, my friend is gone, I miss my friend. Well, I have a friend, and my friend is gone, and I miss my friend, but we didn't have a sexual relationship. So I don't think that we have solid proof that he ever had any sexual relationships with men. There is one story about him being on ship, and maybe he had a relationship, but we're not sure, and he never admits to that. We know that Alain Locke lusted after him like crazy, but we also don't have any real proof that they ever had a sexual relationship. But we do know that he did have sexual relationships with women. So for me, until I uncover something that says, okay, there it is, then I'll have to be like he's advised and do nothing about it.
That's why the song Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me is very important. Because symbolically, I think he's speaking to us.
Yeah.
A lot of people have found it convenient to take Langston Hughes for their own either political, ideological, or aesthetic purposes. If you look at members of the gay community, for example, they like to point to Langston as somebody who was indeed gay because what it does is it gives their own movement greater legitimacy. If you look at the film that was created several years ago, Looking for Langston, it's a marvelous film, but I think it's probably mistitled because it doesn't really talk about Langston per se. What it talks about is the problems of being a gay artist in a world that does not acknowledge their artistry. So that to me is a different sort of thing. With Langston Hughes, there was no question about his artistry. People differed about whether or not he was a true artist. You opened with the notion that he was the poet laureate of unofficial poet laureate of Africa America, and but there were those who felt that the blues poetry, the jazz poetry that he wrote, made him not the poet laureate, but the poet low rate of Africa America. They were embarrassed by that. So not everybody agreed about the significance of his work, but nevertheless, his is an enduring body of writing, and we have to say that there's a lot there that needs to still be dealt with. And we like to think that My Dear Boy in some small way contributes to enlarging our understanding of Langston. We try not to be like those folk who have some sort of ideological axe to grind, and which is to say that they wanted to use him for their own particular purposes. What we were seeking to do was to try to find a way to penetrate that veil that he so artfully placed across his personal life. There are all these moments when we see individuals saying, Langston was just so gregarious. He was just so outgoing. He was just so humorous and just a wonderful person to be around. But almost to a person, they said, there came a point, though, when things got too close to his heart that he tended to shut down. And so what we were seeking to do is to see if we could peek behind that veil just a little bit and see if we might be able to get more information about the inner Langston that's taking place. And so the way in which we selected to do that, of course, was through looking at his family relationships and through the art that he created, which talks about the nature of those relationships.
You know, and I think that we need to also consider that probably had Langston been gay, and maybe he was, it would have been a lot, it would have been received very much differently then than it does now. For him, that probably would have shut down a lot of avenues to success. Now it wouldn't matter. But then I think to admit having been gay would have caused him more problems than it would have solved or than it would have advanced anything.
Yeah, especially among the people that he endeared himself to, which were the folks who were furthest down, many of whom were very much rooted in the Baptist and Methodist churches. They would probably be less appreciative of his success had they considered him to be a gay writer at that time.
Right. Yeah. I just wanted to thank you so much for this wonderful work, my dear boy, Carrie Hughes' letters to Langston Hughes, 1926 to 1938. It is just marvelous, and I am so looking forward to reading with a different eye the work, you know, Not Without Laughter, his play Mulatto, which looks at more specifically his relationship with his father, reading The Negro Mother again, Soul Gone Home, I don't know that play, and then all of his work. I mean, we every December, you know, we look at Black Nativity, and they just had a movie come out last year, you know, thematically based on his play. And yeah, it's just because I mean, he is our poet, you know. I mean, he's the first one that I know to make a living at his craft and to have such a huge body of work. I mean, Langston Hughes, I mean, Zora Neale Hurston, James Baldwin, oh my goodness, you know, like, but Langston Hughes, like, he is the one. I mean, everybody, no matter where in the world you go, people know Langston Hughes.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for having us on the show. This was fun.
Well, we deeply
appreciate
your interest in our work and giving us the opportunity to share this with your listeners. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, looking forward to, you know, further conversations. Yeah, I'm looking forward to what you all come up with next.
Okay.
Right, take good care. Thank you so much.
You too.
All right, you're welcome.
Anytime.
All right.
Peace and blessings. Bye.
Bye.
Good morning, Risa. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Wanda?
I'm well. I'm well. Thank you so much for joining us along with Katie. Are you in the studio?
I am, yes. Hi.
Hi. And Adrian, are you in the studio?
I am indeed. Or, hello, Wanda.
Hi. And RV John, are you in the studio?
RV John actually wasn't able to join us this morning, unfortunately, but we're all here.
Okay. Okay, excellent, excellent. Well, you have another premiere, right? So you're just like just such a creative genius. I mean, you just come up with this wonderful, wonderful work, and your collaborations, you know, with the Third Street Youth Center and Clinic. This is not your first collaboration. That is just really wonderful. You know, the stories that you're telling about communities, particularly, you know, the community in Bayview Hunters Point, and in this one here, looking at, you know, the shipyard. My mother worked at the shipyard, and sort of this impact. Yeah, I remember my mother. She worked on the big computers there, and she'd bring home the cards that they do the key punch on. Yeah, so, yeah, it was back when it was, you know, it's closed now, but back when they were still using it. So I'm so looking forward to seeing Point Shipyard. I wish my mother was living in Northern California because I'm sure she could really resonate with the piece. And it's going to be really great that you're having it at the Museum of the African Diaspora for your ninth season, because what was the piece that you did there a while back at MOAD?
That piece was Mixed Messages, and that, too, was a collaboration with Third Street Youth Center Clinic, and that was about San Francisco's multiracial community. So mm-hmm. we had a lot of different members from that community tell their stories, and with Third Street Youth Center and Clinic, with the young people, they were dancing in it, and it was, you know, part of, I think, the first collaboration that we had really done together as a group.
Right, yeah. So maybe maybe before I introduce you all, you know, give your bios, mention that Risa Simpson is choreographer and master teacher and artistic director of Push Dance Company. And Katie Wong is a dancer and choreographer who relocated to the Bay Area by way of New Jersey, New York, and Beijing. That's awesome. And then Adrian Ramirez is a performer, choreographer, filmmaker who is based in San Francisco Bay Area, and he's been a member of Push Dance Company since 2012, first performing as a soloist and artistic director, Risa Simpson's Bitter Melon. So I'll read more of your bios later, but I wanted to first ask you if you could talk about Point Shipyard Project as opposed to my reading, what's here in the press uh-huh. release, if we have you live. And then maybe you could start, and then Katie and Adrian, you could talk about this project and what it means to you. This, you know, it's real site-specific, but it's not necessarily just unique to the San Francisco Bay Area, what's happening at Point Shipyard and what Point Shipyard is to the community that it lives in.
That's true. I mean, you know, you mentioned that your mom worked there, and I think for a lot of us, today it's hard to imagine what the shipyard was like, but it really was a place where a lot of San Francisco's economy was built out of. And when it shut down in the 70s, it really affected Bayview Hunters Point, and people there have not been able to adjust to the changing economics that came to their families and putting food on the table and also the future of their kids. So Point Shipyard Project takes a look at what that area will look like in 2024, and that's 10 years from now. The youth that we work with are 12 through 24 years of age, so some of them will be in their 30s and 20s at that point. And many of them, you know, they go off to college, but they want to come back and be a part of San Francisco and still be a resident of Bayview Hunters Point. So for them, they see their future outside of the area that they were born in. So they're being forced to think that, hey, I won't be able to afford this area. The Navy is cleaning up the shipyard. We did an earlier piece about the toxins, and this one is about the, you know, changing landscape. Once that, you know, that area is returned to San Francisco City, it's already being handed over to private developers to build homes. But quite a few of these homes, I mean, I don't know if anybody here can afford to buy a home in San Francisco. So this is what we're looking at. And the logistics of the piece being in the museum itself is one where the audience is free to walk around 15 minutes before the show starts to just watch each dancer in their own space, their own home, and their own tableau. And then the audience will continue down to the lobby and watch the dancers on the staircase. And the dancers are making this journey to a new place, it seems like. And there are obstacles for some of the audience members. And for other audience members, it's easy for them to travel up and down the staircase. But others find that they have to, you know, go through barriers. And that's a symbolism for the life of young people in Hunters Point. And from there, they are taken up to the second floor, and there's about 5 to 6 poems directly from the youth that will be played through a recording, and the dancers will be moving to that music that they have created on the second floor. So it's, you know, it's, there's a lot to mitigate in this piece as a choreographer. And, I mean, I'm sure that the dancers can speak to their own experiences being in the work as well. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of different stories. And depending on who you are, the viewer or the dancer, I think that there's some things that you'll pick up from the piece that will just be unique to your own experience. And that's what I really enjoy about, you know, this season, is that it's very different from anything I've ever done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Katie?
Yeah. I think what's been so fascinating for me during this process has been sort of two realizations that I've had. One, that it's been a wonderful opportunity to sort of get to know the city a little bit better, especially being one who's relocated here, and understanding more historical neighborhoods, including the Bayview, and what the landscape and picture was like just, you know, 40 to 50 years ago, and really appreciating how it all seems to have a pattern to it. And we've had the opportunity to do a lot of research and sort of understand what it was like before I've lived here. And, you know, just seeing how there might be this connection with relocation and sort of gentrification in certain neighborhoods in San Francisco, from the Fillmore and the Western Addition, which was like a thriving community, to the Bayview, which is definitely seeing change right now. And while, you know, there are a lot of issues still going on there, including, you know, gang-related activities and foreclosure kind of thing, there's still such culture and history there. And so it's been a really wonderful experience to get to understand that more and appreciate what there is going on in that neighborhood right now and how this change really affects all the locals there. And then also it's a great way to understand the more universal aspects of the piece, and how sort of change and our economy in the U.S. recently has really affected our youth and our youth culture, and sort of what people think of as their home, and how upsetting and concerning it can be when you have that thought that you might not be able to return to it if you do move on to something like college or a job somewhere else or something like that. And so I think trying to capture all of those ideas in one dance event is challenging but also extremely exciting as an artist. And listening to the words that were written by the Third Street Youth Clinic participants in this project has been really inspiring. And I think it's a very powerful score that Raisa and the students have worked on together. And it definitely affects our movement and the way that we try to tell the story through the dance. And it's also just been a wonderful experience getting the time to work at the Museum of African Diaspora. It's such a unique space in a wonderful area of the city, like a totally thriving, like active, frenetic area with all this other kind of art around it, but also so close to the financial district. So it's got such an interesting just relationship within the city, and it's got these wonderful, huge windows that just like looks down upon the streets and the activity, and to be able to connect with people visually as well, both on the outside and on the inside of the museum. It's such a unique experience as a performer, and I'm really looking forward to presenting it to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Katie. Adrienne.
Yeah.
So I agree with Katie. I'm also a transplant to San Francisco. I think a big population of San Francisco are transplants. And I am really thankful to be able to be here. And I think one of the first things we talked about when creating this piece was how do we kind of become part of the solution and not be a part of the problems, because, I mean, we're not native to these cities. And I think what's great about this piece is that it's not just kind of applicable to San Francisco, Hunters Point, Bayview. It's kind of something that's happening all over America, and it's this gentrification that's happening. And, you know, I left San Francisco for about 5 months and came back, and I could see it happen even more. I saw all the change that's happening, and especially in Hunters Point, Bayview. And working with Raisa on this piece has been a great experience, because basically it kind of challenges you as a person and as an artist to kind of ask these questions that you'd rather not kind of ask yourselves, and you'd rather ignore. You'd kind of saying, like, well, you know, those people who are out on the streets right now that you pass by every single day, like, you know, a couple of months ago they could have had a home, but, you know, they could have been moved out as well. And so, you know, it's kind of about making these people, because they are people, less of just like these figures that you pass by, and more human, because when you pass by these people, you can ignore them and, you know, just find them annoying if they're like asking you for money. But you know what? At the end of the day, like, they're human just like you are, and they weren't always in the position that they are now. And it's just kind of looking at the piece, is just kind of looking at the kind of struggle that's happening with the youth in Bayview, Hunters Point, and how they're kind of worried that, you know, they grew up in this city, they grew up in Bayview, Hunters Point, and now it's slowly kind of becoming this gentrified spot in San Francisco. Where are they going to go now? Where do they have to go? And I'm also really thankful that we are using the track that we are, the score that we're using for the piece, because, again, Raisa, you worked with the Third Street Youth Center, and it's raw. It's exactly what they're feeling, and you can hear it in their words. It's beautiful. It truly is. The first time we heard it, it was just kind of, it was just really insane, because these are people who are going through exactly what you are wanting to portray in, like, this kind of conceptual piece. And this is what they're experiencing on a day-to-day life. Like, I can try to embody as much as I want what they are feeling. But at the end of the day, like, dancing to the words of somebody who is experiencing it is a completely different aspect, which is something I really appreciate and helps me get to the root of what the piece is truly about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Thanks, Adrian. Raisa, I saw you last week at ODC. You were one of the choreographers in the closing weekend at Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now, and that was just quite wonderful watching, you know, in the draft piece that Robert Moses had, you know, choreographed, you know, all of you all having your pieces together and then fitting them together into a story. That was simply amazing. And you do some really amazing work, you know, as a choreographer and also as a performance artist. And I just want to read a little bit more of your bio. Says that after receiving your BFA from the Conservatory of Dance at SUNY Purchase, Simpson had an extensive performance career in the San Francisco Bay Area, dancing with Robert Moses Ken and Joanna Hackett's Zacco Dance Theater, among others. And I've seen you in a lot of Zacco Dance Theater performances. The last one was the one about W.E.B. Du Bois's notion of two-ness, and that was simply phenomenal. And then the one where, you know, the black folks were migrating, leaving San Francisco, sail away. And that was another one, considering that you were injured and I couldn't tell. that was like, wow, the show must go on. Like, wow, what a trooper, you know, that you came back after that injury to finish out, you know, that weekend run. You were hailed by Dance Spirit magazine as reflective contemporary choreographer, and you presented your work at First Center for the Arts at Georgia Tech, Sacramento State University, where I believe you were a visiting scholar. Joyce Soho, Washington Ensemble Theater, Evolve Dance Festival in New York, Los Angeles Theater Center Black Choreographer Festival, which we just mentioned, Reinberg Theater, and many more. And currently you're a guest choreographer with San Francisco State University and Marin Academy. And Katie, you graduated cum laude from Princeton University with a BA in anthropology, which I'm sure comes in really handy, East Asian Studies and Dance. There you perform works by Camille A. Brown, Zivi, how do you pronounce her name?
Ziv.
Yeah. How do you say the last name?
I'm trying to remember.
His
company is called Z-Dance.
Okay, Z-Dance, okay. Susan Marshall, Mark Morris, and Twyla Tharp. After graduation, you moved to Beijing as a teaching fellow where you trained with the Beijing LDTX Modern Dance Company, choreographed for the Future Dance Ensemble of Peking University, and launched a series of dance workshops for Migrant Children's Foundation. Sounds fascinating. You have also choreographed for Bric-a-Brac, which was awarded the Best of San Francisco Fringe Festival. You have danced with Bianca Cabrera, Sierra Bayer, Ronnie Reddick, Louis Aquisto, Ann Wren Petrarca, I hope they don't kill me, Philly, Zero Productions, and Dance Lumiere. She currently danced with Prince Dance Project Concept 04 and Desandro Matavo, and she's on to be both a dancer and resident choreographer with Push this season. And Adrian Ramirez is, again, a performer, choreographer, filmmaker who is based in San Francisco. Adrian, what films have you made?
What films did I make? Well, when I was home in my hometown of El Centro, California, which is this very, 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 very small agricultural town in Southern California, I made a film called California Dreamin', which was set
I know that film.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
That's
fabulous. Well, keep on going, sorry. Yeah, keep on going.
That's fabulous. that was set to the dialogue of a documentary entitled Paris is Burning, and it was accepted into a gay film festival in London, England, called Deep Desires and Broken Dreams, and I recently had a screening here in San Francisco. And I've also made another short film called Londres, which was filmed on location in London, England as well. It's a very new and recent kind of development in my artistry, so I'm exploring it and just wanting to be as well-rounded of an artist as I could possibly be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how wonderful. Congratulations. Wow, well, you have to let me know next time you have some screenings of Deep Desires and Broken Dreams. I just love the title of that one.
Oh, it's a great one. It's a great film festival in London. They show amazing films, and I was really, really honored to be a part of the whole lineup. I mean, I was just very honored.
Yeah. And so besides performing in Risa's Bitter Melon, you perform works by San Francisco's ODC dance directors, K.T. Nelson. Yeah, they've got a season coming up, like, next week, or dancing,
it's
the
right
dancing
now.
Downtown. Is it right now? Oh, no.
It's now and next week as well.
Oh, yeah, because each week is a different thing. Thanks for reminding me. It's like, oh, I want to put that in my book.
I said you can see our show and their show. We'll get you out in time because ours is in the afternoon. Theirs is in the evening.
Okay, cool. Make a day of it. That'll be fun. Yeah, and you've danced, Adrian, for Bay Area choreographers Ray Taddeo and Kathleen McCarthy. And under your own collection, New Opulence Arts, your choreography and projects have been showcased at various venues throughout San Francisco and London, England. When you said you were out of town, I thought you were from London because I didn't see El Centro, California anywhere in your bio. You should claim it.
Oh, man. I need to claim it. People are going to be really upset with me.
Yeah, So back to Point Shipyard Project, which, again, is going to be at MOAD Saturday, March 29th at 1 p.m. and 3, and Sunday, March 30th at 1 and 3. And the Museum of the African Diaspora is located at 685 Mission Street in San Francisco. And you can visit pushdance.org for information about tickets and the Point Shipyard Project. I was just reading in the press release about Point Shipyard Project's experimental approach, fostering artistic development for collaborating artists and dancers while providing a platform for each performance and partner to discover more about their own personal and cultural histories, which I think you talked about a bit in your, just sort of when we went around a little while ago, but maybe you might want to go deeper. Many of the Third Street youth take pride in their neighborhood and hope to be positive influences in its future development while being simultaneously impacted by the ongoing displacement of families and low-income residents of Bayview Hunters Point through the gentrification process. According to Time magazine, over 60% of people of color live next to a toxic waste site, a statistic clearly evident in several of the region's communities, Richmond, West Oakland, and Bayview Hunters Point. Through the performance inquiry of environmental racism and gentrification, PUSH uncovers testimonials from Bayview Hunters Point youth rarely expressed in a public arena, and Point Shipyard Project facilitates a frank discourse on race relations within the context of a powerful and multidisciplinary rendering of a very complex and timely social issue. I wanted to ask you about Risa, I call you both of them. I usually call you Risa, but I hear Adrian calling you Risa. It's like, okay. I know you're from, I believe, the Pacific Northwest, like Seattle. Yeah.
I'm from Seattle.
Are you from the Pacific Northwest?
No, I was born in Cleveland, but
Cleveland. Okay, you went to school in Pacific Northwest. Is that the deal?
No, that was PUSH's first tour. We had our first tour in Seattle.
Oh, that's why I keep on putting you there. Oh, okay. Yeah, but you know, a lot of your pieces, particularly your solo work, sort of looks at, you know, being biracial, bicultural, and that usually comes out, sort of in the philosophical place that PUSH takes us. And I'm sure that also probably has, something around, the attraction that you have, with, this particular region and particular area of the San Francisco Bay Area, because, it just seems to be really fertile for you. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you work with the Third Street Youth Center and Clinic, how you elicit, these stories, these poems, and then there's also a soundtrack. I mean, there's like music. And I'm going to play that for our audience, at the end of our conversation, because it's 15 minutes long and I couldn't cut it. I didn't have time to figure out how to do that. So we couldn't like interrupt our conversation with a little bit here and a little bit there. So they're just going to just get it all. And so I was wondering if you could talk about sort of that process. And I was wondering, Katie and Adrian, if you could maybe talk about if everyone was there, like if the whole company is at, the Third Street Youth Center, because it sounds as if you know these young people. And then how do you do justice to their story? How do you embody this, in a way that's authentic and true? Because it seems as if, all of you can relate to the stories, but then it's not your story per se, so you are embodying someone else's story, but you want to be authentic, and of course you will be. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that artistic process. So, Risa, you can start.
Yeah, as a choreographer, it's very important for you to look inside at yourself and learn about your own personal history and story and identity. So, for me, diving into my own culture as a mixed heritage person, I've always known about my African American culture, and as an adult, I've started to really learn more about my Filipino culture inside. And having done that has led me to really want to know about other people's stories and histories. and their own personal stories. So this is not a historic representation of Bayview Hunters Point at all. This is something that is very reflective of today's climate and changing economic disparity. These disparities are brought on via a lot of capitalism, and capitalism should work for everybody, but it's not. So that's, you know, the lead into this, is that the youth often are nameless, they're faceless, and they just sort of fall through the cracks when it comes to talking about how we can, you know, make San Francisco in particular, which used to be very bohemian and very inclusive to all types of incomes, how we can make it a place where everyone can live. Right now, people don't really fully understand the extent of how quickly San Francisco has changed, but a teacher and an artist, you know, even a journalist cannot afford to live in San Francisco. And part of that is because right now in the country, we're making less than people did in the 1970s. During the 1970s, income levels sort of tabled off, and now they're dropping. Not only are we making less, but our taxes are higher, our products cost more, our food is much more difficult to put on the table. So it's not about, you know, any sort of politics or anything, but it's about right now, you know, we have workers in the middle class turning into the poor. And this is the shift that we're seeing. Now, as an artist, I mean, I've always lived on an artist's income. So for me, you know, I've just sort of sustained my living. However, through the evictions that are happening in San Francisco with, you know, private citizens like myself finding that, you know, the owners of the apartment buildings want to sell the building and sell it to a developer who has money, it's basically displacing people like myself. And, you know, it's a hot topic. It's happening in the Mission, but it's been happening in Bayview for quite some time. And when I started to look at the youth, I wanted to get their story. They were doing my story with, you know, mixed messages. And I flipped it around and said, I want to hear your story. So what are you guys feeling and going through? Do you know that there's a naval shipyard that's going through a toxic cleanup? And for many of them, they didn't know that this area was right next to Candlestick Park, which is right next to Third Street Youth Center Clinic and near where they live. So it surprised me, it surprised them to research this area and learn about all the toxics there in the ground. There's a San Francisco Department of Public Health statistic that 1 in 6 youth in that area has asthma. So our last piece, something left over from the last, talks specifically about the youth that had asthma. And we were working with 6 youth total, and 2 of them had asthma, and that's in our documentary. And everyone can view that on our Vimeo if they want more information on that process. So now, you know, looking at Point Shipyard Project, it was just a logical step to really start talking about these changes in San Francisco and the fact that because this is quite specific to Bayview Hunters Point, and a lot of San Franciscans in general didn't know that this is going on in that area, that we really focus on that. I mean, we can attribute these changes to things that happened in the Western Addition back, you know, in the 50s. Or, you know, we could even go back to what happened to, you know, the Ohlone people and Native Americans back before this was even California. But now, like I said, we're not looking at the historical representations. We're really looking at the youth that are the future and trying to form possibly, you know, an understanding of what we know is going to happen but hasn't happened yet, but just capturing their feelings behind it. So it's quite powerful. And like, you know, Katie and Adrian said, without these stories, we can't make this piece. Without the youth, you know, recording their stories, writing down their stories, playing it, you know, as we're dancing, it would be quite difficult. As a choreographer, I've found that I've had to ask people to stop dancing and to really tap into these emotions of loss and displacement that are being captured in the soundtrack. You know, it's like, oh, that step was beautiful, but what she's saying right now is that she's about to lose her home. So how can we stop and just get some, like, human body language that actually represents losing your home?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's one of the things I think that for all artists, and especially for dancers, having formal training, trained bodies, the most difficult thing is for a choreographer to say, you know, okay, stop dancing. It's confusing. It's like, what do you mean? What do you mean I can't extend my arm like this? It's like, no, you can't do it that way. You have to actually do it like a human being. And, I mean, just being in the museum, I'm walking up the steps, but I'd rather dance up the steps. But I have to walk up the steps. Somebody from Big View Hunters Point would. Anybody off the street really would. So we're really pushing ourselves dramatically, and we're really tapping into a level of that sort of art where, like I think you mentioned, embodying something has to be very prevalent and real and has to be authentic. So I think that overall, I mean, the dancers are doing that, and they're doing something that I didn't expect to happen. As I'm watching this in the museum, I'm starting to see the meaning, the core meaning and the core value of diaspora. And, I mean, we might ask, what is diaspora? Diaspora is the movement of people. And here in the Museum of African Diaspora, we begin to see other images around us of slavery, of great migration. And I began to ask myself as an artist, well, how is this any different from the forced migration that's happening right now in Baby Hunter's Point? Are we coming back to another movement of forced migration? And where are we migrating to? Where's the next place? And how do we adapt to this? Or do we choose to stay? You know, what is that? I know that after slavery, you know, like in Joanna Haigood's piece, people came to California, and once they faced discrimination here, they went to Canada. You know, what forces you or what makes you to have to make that decision to stay or to go? And if you do stay, what's here for you? And when you do go, is it a better place? So that's what's happening now for me. And, you know, moving into next week, it's next week. I have to start making some decisions as, you know, what am I going to keep? What am I going to portray? How is this piece going to really tell the story of Third Street Youth Center and Clinic and all of the youth there? Sam Owens, Tim Toaster Henderson, Fred Jackson, Shaquilla, Dennis Jones, all those folks, you know, and that's the next step.
As you respond to the overall question, Katie, I was wondering if you could also speak to legacy and with the young people, what they saw as their legacy, since we're looking at Bayview Hunter's Point beyond to 2024.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a wonderful question, actually. And I think that we've just learned so much from our interactions with the youth at the Bayview Clinic, and especially from one person that Risa just mentioned, Dennis Jones, who has actually personally performed with us in our live production of our last piece, which is also about the Shipyard Project, more seriously focused on the environmental causes and issues and concerns there. And I think just from after speaking with them, it's really eye-opening to see that a few sort of subjects that arise, one being like just making it through their daily lives and sort of not even being considering what their legacy might be in the future, just trying to push through and deal with so many obstacles that they're given and rise above them. And that's been just really awe-inspiring. And, you know, so many of them, as Raisa was saying, deal with medical issues that they're really no sure cause for, including asthma and other issues. And then others just have, you know, family situations and economic strains and that kind of thing. And so it's really just to see them make it to the Third Street Youth Clinic to work on something with Raisa is really wonderful, because it is interesting to take on the perspective and see how challenging it can be just to make it there, and how difficult it can be just to have opportunity to work with another artist and to speak out on what's going on in their lives and how it's affecting them and what their opinions are about it, and then also putting it towards a bigger use in creating a score, how to kind of put it in spoken word form, what kind of music should go behind it, what are the rhythms associated with your emotions, how can you kind of transcend just this conversation that we had all together and make it into art and something that can be interpreted by other people and understood and universalized. So that's been really wonderful to see with the youth. It's also really interesting to remember that they're not much younger than myself or especially Adrian are. You know, we're basically within the same generation. And so I think speaking to your point about how do we sort of personalize and feel connected to something that really isn't happening to us, I think that's one thing that I really like to reflect on and remember, that I just went through all of these similar transitions in my life, just as going from an adolescent to an adult, and just, you know, in a suburban neighborhood is difficult. Just making all those decisions and trying to figure out what's next for you in your future, and to imagine it going on in an urban neighborhood that's transforming before your very eyes is a lot to take in. And so I really try to reflect on those things and listen to the words that they've so kindly shared with us within the score and within the few chances we've had to talk together and to perform together. But it is true that I do think they are looking forward and looking into the future, and with this challenge of becoming an adult and seeking adulthood, trying to figure out what it is that their legacy is. And I do know many of them do still feel very close to where they grew up and their neighborhoods, and they're concerned with what will become of the city, because it's a lot of who they hold or what they hold as their identity. But I do also know that many of them see future with so much potential, and in case it might not remain in Bayview, Hunters Point, it might be all about going to school, learning more about music, learning more about the arts, going on athletic scholarships, or just becoming more educated and more open-minded about the world, and or even just, you know, finding your own job and becoming self-sufficient. So I think, you know, it's a group of people who are still definitely in that transition phase, and they've begun to think about what their legacy could be, but I still think it's a very fresh idea for them, as it is for myself and for many of the other dancers in PUSH. But it's really wonderful to sort of all collaborate together and get perspectives from everyone and be pushed to grow and to see what's going on around us and how our lives parallel and how they veer away from one another.
Yeah, thanks, Katie. Adrian.
Yes.
If you could speak to, you know, the collaborative process and the embodiment of these stories and how you get mixed in there too, and the legacy if this is your generation as well, the legacy that you hope for in the coming years.
Yeah, well, speaking on the collaborating and the actual process, I mean, and how we kind of fit into the story that's being told is, you know, the way we start is sitting down in a circle in rehearsals, and, you know, Raisa basically asks us all of these questions about, you know, like, what do you know about the area? What do you know about the youth there? What did you know that there is even, you know, a naval shipyard? And, you know, a lot of us didn't know that. And then we go from there. We start digging deeper and asking more questions. How do you feel about, you know, the gentrification that's happening, you know, in your own city? And, like, how do you feel about it, you know, personally? How do you feel like it personally affects you? And so in that way, it already kind of becomes very personal to us because we are experiencing it as well. Not on the same level as, you know, some of the kids that we're trying to tell a story of, but we are experiencing it to some point. So getting to work with the youth, and especially, like, as Katie mentioned, one of the poets, his name is Dennis Jones. We got to work with him on our last piece, and he's actually writing something for this performance as well. And it's just been really great because they can really just speak from the heart, and it's all they know. They don't have any other kind of motives, or they don't have anything else to prove. It's just, it's all they've known. I mean, they grew up in this city. This is their home. And for people to come and, you know, completely change it while they're still living here, it's just kind of mind-blowing. And they can see it happening, and they can feel it, and it's not welcoming. And so getting to hear their stories and getting to apply them, and it can be quite interesting because it then starts to open up your eyes, and it becomes almost like a reflection or like a mirror back to you. Like, how are you acting? How do you feel about this situation? And are you being part of the problem? And of some of the times I'll be walking around the streets in downtown, and I really will ask myself these questions and seriously kind of reorganize the way that I go about treating others. And, you know, not to say that I treat anybody badly, but even, you know, to the people who are kind of just like laying on the floor and they don't really have anywhere to go, and it really makes you think, like, it's not because, you know, it can't just be because of one reason. There's so many other reasons that are happening right now to these people that's happening. So getting to work with the youth on this project is extremely important, especially about leaving some sort of legacy. And like Katie said, I don't think it's something that's on the forefront of their mind. And I don't think by them adding anything to this project, do they realize that they're kind of creating a legacy for themselves? And I think in that way, it's kind of beautiful because they're doing it just out of the passion of their hearts. They're not really doing it so they can say that they've done it. They're doing it because they really feel passionately about it. And getting to work with that kind of raw passion is really kind of freeing, and it's really special. Because, I mean, we can say we know all about it, and we can say that, you know, we understand, but we can say we empathize, and we truly do, but can we really put ourselves in the situation? So working with them really gives us a better understanding of gives us a better understanding of what's really happening. And getting to work with Raisa is interesting because unlike any of the other choreographers I think I've worked with, it's much more about bringing consciousness to something that people don't usually want to talk about. And it's not always the happiest thing, and it's something that a lot of people would rather not talk about. And I think an interesting thing about her is that she doesn't always, you know, bring these students and these artists, these young artists, to, you know, her comfort zone or where she feels like they need to be. She really goes into their homes. She goes into their kind of, like, safe space, which is, you know, Hunter's Bayview, Hunter's Point Bayview, and feels it on, you know, firsthand experience. She gets to see, you know, what, like, what they're experiencing and really builds relationships with these kids, and it's really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very honored to be a part of that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Adrian. Raisa, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, and then I want you to tell us about the soundscape that I'm going to play for our audience in closing of our conversation. Talk about, you know, just PUSH, PUSH Dance Company, sort of the genesis of PUSH Dance Company, because just sort of piggybacking on what Adrian said and Katie about, you know, not necessarily having an agenda, you know, that that you want to further necessarily in the art, but actually, you know, going to a place where one might not be as comfortable about what's going to come out when you start, you know, sort of digging and excavating and, you know, sort of bringing to light, you know, some issues that need to be brought to light, because, you know, you actually have access to a public and to a stage that perhaps these children, if you hadn't necessarily collaborated with them, not to say that they wouldn't have necessarily gotten the stories out, but definitely makes it easier, you know, when a company such as yours comes in and says, okay, can we work together, you know, because I value you know, your stories, and I want others to know them. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of that whole way of working, as well as I have another question about the Point Shipyard project. The piece about the pollution, I thought that was last summer, if I'm not mistaken.
It was last BCF, so that would have been February 2013. Oh, we did it again in the summer, you're right.
Yeah, you did the whole thing, yeah, because I was out of the country and I missed it. And I was like, oh, heck. yeah, and I was wondering, is there a third Point Shipyard project piece, or, like, since it says project, you could have, like, other pieces coming up?
There is. We're gonna do this piece just very quickly in the fall, but it's going to be different. It's going to be in a traditional theater. So you're right. The project will certainly live on. And, you know, I think that we're just kindred spirits, really, with Baby Hunter's Point and Thirsty Youth Center. We are kindred spirits. Right now, PUSH is experiencing its own gentrification. The cost of theaters has shot up, you know, 80%. And for dance, it's becoming extinct in San Francisco. And I think that for all artists that experience it, and, you know, for them, their response is to do street art and just put their art up on the street. And for us, it's to go into these public spaces like the MOAD and the museum that, you know, are really partnering with us. So I really want to, you know, thank the Museum of the African Diaspora. I really want to thank San Francisco Artists Commission, Zella Bach Family Foundation, the Flyshacker Family Foundation as well, these foundations and our individual supporters who are really helping us to sustain our art and dance. And we're a young dance company. This is our ninth season. And, you know, you see all the big companies are going into their 30s, 40s, and 50s. But, you know, we're just starting at the tip of the iceberg as what we're going to be doing artistically. And, you know, I hope that we can remain, all my artists can remain, you know, and sustain their living here in the city. But it's difficult. It really is. It's not something that has anything to do with what we're doing. You know, we're we're becoming more popular. We just had a successful tour to Georgia, and we've gone to New York. It has to do with just the changes here in San Francisco. And the city, you know, has been good, but I think that they're starting to learn that artists, dance companies, choreographers like myself make the city great. So there's been moves, you know, by a few of the district supervisors to really push for keeping nonprofits and the arts here for tourism and, you know, for the city and beautification. But I think that for push, we're going to remain a dance company that keeps telling these stories because they are unique and they do have to do with people's lives. They're hard to describe. Are we part of the problem? No. I don't think that we are. We're not, you know, going into Bayview Hunters Point and dropping down $5,000 for an apartment that should only be $500. We're not. You know, when we go into areas, we just sort of blend in. We create our art. We involve the community. We sit down and talk to people, and we learn what it is that they need, and then we create our art. Our art is a response to the community members that live here. So I think that we're actually creating remedies to some of the problems around us. And, you know, the future of PUSH is one that it was built by the people around me, and I think that, you know, I've opened it up artistically. Like, Katie will be our resident choreographer. She'll be making a new work in the fall. And, you know, Adrian definitely is, you know, expanding upon film, which is something that we love. So there are all these creative people around me, and they all have their own talents and individuality about them that, you know, makes this dance company special. So, you know, that's what we are, and that's what we'll continue to be, and we'll, you know, just move forward and innovate. But I just wanted to just, you know, put that out there that as artists, we're definitely, you know, in line with what San Francisco and what the people here really want. And, you know, for the new people who are moving in, who have all these resources, just come and help out. Come and see the show, you know, volunteer at the youth center. They would love it. Don't think that, you know, our doors aren't open. Our doors are always open to everybody. A lot of the youth don't have computers in their homes, and I know a lot of tech companies that are moving here could definitely be a benefit and a resource to the youth. They're definitely interested. They're making music on GarageBand and everything else, so, you know, they're like steps ahead of some of us who look at computers and are just like, okay, well, that's great. So they're talented. They learn fast. They're just amazing. I just, you know, want to really praise the work that they've done, and I think Katie and Adrian have done a great job of saying that too. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Go ahead and chime in, guys, if you...
Yeah, I mean, I think Raisa could speak best to the identity and the future, definitely of PUSH Dance Company, but as a dancer and performer with the company, even just in the last 2.5 or 3 seasons together, I've seen so much growth and yet also a clarity of the company's sort of mission and identity as well. Come forth, and it's been really wonderful working this whole time and all of the projects that we've had the chance to work on together, and I'm really excited to be able to give back more as a resident choreographer this season as well. And, yeah, just all of the things that the company represents definitely rings true to me as a multicultural person in this country, and also as you know, 20-something-year-old just kind of trying to survive, and as Jason said, as an artist, making these important connections with people in the community, being a storyteller, utilizing art for like social benefit and for moving our society forward in a positive and productive direction. And yeah, it's just, it's all been extremely exciting, and I felt just so honored and privileged to be able to explore this with the company and have these opportunities, and to learn more about the youth at the Third Street Clinic, too. It's definitely a place that I know without knowing Risa and without working with Push, I would have no idea about. And I actually am a resident on Potrero Hill, which is, shares like the same district with the Bayview. So I even feel closer to them now, and I'm glad that I've had this opportunity to learn more.
And I think, you know, the sound score that people are going to hear, it has, you know, they put in airplane sounds, they put in, you know, this metronome that has this, like, ticking, you know, time bomb kind of feeling to it, too. So, you know, it brings in those feelings of the isolation that they feel, as well as, you know, how they kind of just, their music really just portrays them being just, like, squeezed out of the American dream in a way. So you'll hear, you know, are you playing the whole 15 minutes? Because it's really...
Yeah, I'm going to play the whole 15
great.
Minutes. Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to hear the various poetry, and the music that you'll hear, especially in the beginning, was composed by Kenny Amons, and he's one of the youth. And then towards the end, you'll hear the music director. His name is Daryl Davis. He's also the director of the center. He composed the last portion, and he mixed it into one of the poems that Toaster did. You'll hear towards the end. But it's really just a world-class score, and I know that it's very difficult to compose music for dance. And I know that choreographers like myself are very selective in what they use for the background of their dances. So it's really, you know, it's an attribute to them that they were able to do this so successfully. And I'm looking forward to taking this piece wherever on tour, because I think it's just that powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I want to thank you, Risa Simpson, Katie Wong, and Adrienne Ramirez, for joining us today to talk about Point Shipyard Project, featuring a musical collaboration with Third Street Youth Center and Clinic. And again, the show is opening Saturday, March 29th. Performances are 1 and and then Sunday, March 30th at 1 and 3 p.m., and that's next week. And it's going to be, they're going to be, the performances are at Museum of the African Diaspora, or MOAD, located at 6-85 Mission Street in San Francisco, right on, right near 3rd Street and Mission in San Francisco. And you can visit pushdance.org for more information. Is information about the 3rd Street Youth Center and Clinic, is that also on the PUSH website?
It is. It's on our outreach page. We do quite a bit of outreach. We're also having school performances on the 27th that are open to schools, and we're also teaching at the African American Art Cultural Complex. We're teaching there for students there. So there's quite a bit of information about the outreach that we do on our website.
Oh, nice, nice. And could you give the Third Street, if you know it, Youth Center and Clinic direct information for people that might be in that area and don't know about the organization?
Yes, so for all you listeners out there, if you want to learn more about Third Street Youth Center and Clinic, you may log on to RD Youth, all one word. So Third Street, all one word, with a 3. .org, and you can find out more information on the website about them.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Oh, super. Well, thank you all so much for joining us. I was going to ask you if you have anything coming up for National Dance Week in April. Do you?
You know, that's so funny. You know, we're going to Sacramento on tour, but I seem to always, you know, and I used to be the project director of the festival, but I always seem to miss it myself now that I'm not involved with it. So we won't be doing anything then, but we are going to Sacramento State for a tour. I'm bringing the company there, and this will be our first tour as a company. I was there as visiting scholar. So that's what's happening in April.
Oh, what's the dates?
That will be April 12th, and it's part of Sac State's Dance Sampler. So there will be other companies there as well.
Oh, nice. Dance Sampler. Okay, great. And all that's on your website?
Yes, that is on our website, pushdance.org. Please visit us.
Okay, super. All righty, so now we're going to listen to this wonderful soundscape you sent us and in anticipation of seeing the work next week. And thank you so much, all of you, for joining us. It's been really a wonderful conversation, and looking forward to having further and looking forward to seeing you at the Museum of the African Diaspora next week.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're
welcome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Peace and blessings.
All right.
My neighborhood filled with blacks. They say it's contaminated. They say it'll be crazy in two shades. It'll be dark until the brightest day. But there's a reason for these violent ways. After examination, I found that discrimination contaminated the water we drink, the soil we use, and the air that we breathe. These chemicals I can't even pronounce. Denounce my hood if it's all good. The air so polluted I guess they can't see through the smog. All the wrong they doing. Trying to move bodies in just to bring corpses out. These chemicals infecting my brain cells. Got me sitting in jail cell because I'm going crazy over this shit. This shit making me sick. Shit, I pray it's not cancer. Your daughter can't even be a dancer.
I'm going crazy over
that asthma.
It's making me
hustle, get her out,
and I pray
it's not cancer.
Her lungs.
Your daughter can't even be a dancer.
Don't
asthma.
Shoot for them dreams.
They gonna say you got a gun.
No run, no run.
The black people out, bring the white people in.
Let them break their back
like we did. Fucking move us out. Let them toxins break them down.
Oh run, oh run. The black people out and bring the white people in. Let them break their backs like we did. Forget it. Move us out and let them toxins break them down.
It was a place in the area where the land was passed down. This is where toxic and bombs were tested. Contaminated land was found. It was never safe when the government came in. Caution. After all the crazy experiments and scientific hype, the land was handed down to the less fortunate. Yes, jobs were provided and homes too, but the land that was given to them was so contaminated.
Many years ago, this was a place many of our relatives found jobs working for the U.S. government. I could easily say that this was just a little piece, a part of the bigger plan to destroy the future homes of the many black people. I mean, this became one of the most toxic places in America.
People have lived here and made this place their lives. Now that they're getting sick and no one knows why. Silence is what is given when the air quality is poor. Silence can be the key because large populations of people are suffering from the air that they breathe.
We became the lost generation. And now after all these years, times is changing. The shipyard is a part of the future development.
Redevelopment is now on the rise, while the community deals with illnesses that are on the rise.
This time won't be jobs for me or you. Soon will be a change. This will no longer be the Hunters Point we've known our whole lives.
No answers to questions. Why does the air smell so funny? Families are suffering, and they don't know why. Illnesses of asthma with young kids is on the rise. Mothers not knowing why, they followed all the right precautions to make a healthy baby. So what can be done to fix the already bad situation? How can you help the families that have no control? I feel a solution is needed because air should be safe and clean. But here in this place in the Bayview, because of their choices?
We won't have homes. We won't have businesses. But I'll tell you what we will have. And that's the crumbs left from the American pie. So I thank all of you that care about the history of the shipyard. Because the future that is coming will make history.
Do not wear hoodies. Do not wear your pants low. Do not wear do-rags, fitted caps, ski caps. Do not wear headgear or anything that's red and black or blue and black or yellow or gold or green and black. Do not wear pink and black or purple. Do not wear black. Do not wear white tees. Suits are fine. Do not wear expensive accessories. Do not wear tattoos or shirts, t-shirts with someone else's dead name on your dying skin. No obituaries. Funerals are fine. Church is fine. Suits are fine. The field is fine. The stage, the X in front of the camera, even the hospitals are fine. Jerseys, scrubs, uniforms, suits are always fine as long as they can count the numbers on your back. Be a number. Do not be a statistic. Know the statistics. Live like a fugitive without being a criminal unless you're hungry. Do not compromise food for dignity. Do not compromise family for food. Do not wait for food. Do not starve your family. Defend your family, but do not provoke police, even if you are the police. Do not speak to police. Do not call police. Do not film police. Do not police police. Do not run from police. Do not hide. Do not confess. Do not wave to police, even if the police look like you. Do not Samaritan. Do not witness crimes. Do not commit crimes. No confrontations, no arguments or gambling or speeding or selling or liquor or sex or sugar. Do not smoke anything. Do not consume anything marketed to you. Do not go anywhere without receipts, alibis, recommendations. Do not make mistakes. Do not compromise food for dignity. Do not starve your family. Do not family without food. Do not wait for food. Take it. Take someone else's food. Take someone else's food that won't tell police. If they call police, wear a suit. Suits are always fine. They box your shoulders, close your throat. A good suit turns your spine into a cushion board. Ready for burial. Suit bury you just fine. Funerals are fine. Funerals are always fine. As long as you die in a suit. Thank you.